It's not an option. It's a right. Cocked, locked, and ready to rock the world of the anti-gunners. You're listening to the guy who had to register his mouth as a full auto weapon. Bill Carnes and Two-Way Radio. The fight for your rights isn't for pansies. So buckle up for the ride and knuckle down with Bill Carnes and 2A Radio.
Booyah! Hello, America. This is Bill Carnes. You're tuned in right here to the Second Amendment Radio Show. We'd like to narrow that down to 2A Radio. The website is 2aradio.com. You can always check us out there. I'm going to open the show today about a complete sellout hack. Now, you'll be interested to see how this is written. It's written with journalism integrity about as tightly knit as a snowflake. There's just, it's all over the place. A guy by the name of Mike Barkley is trying to get the Democrat nomination to run for Congress in his district in Northern California. Now, it says in this article that he is a former member of the National Rifle Association. It also says that he has no qualms with guns for self-protection. Yet, it also says he wants to repeal the Second Amendment. Now, let's start off like this. The Second Amendment is part of the top 10 list of amendments. The first 10 known as the Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights is exactly that. The rest of the constitutional amendments don't spell out God-given rights. They're the way the Constitution was amended. The first 10 just spell out God-given inalienable rights. That's what it is. You cannot repeal a God-given right. A right at birth. You cannot repeal that. And also keep in mind that the Bill of Rights is not, they're not all of your rights. That you couldn't possibly enumerate all of your rights. It's merely a top 10 list, like David Letterman does. Only Letterman starts at 10 and finishes at 1. The Founding Fathers did it in numerical order. They start at 1, finish at 10. You cannot repeal a God-given right. You'd literally have to change the entire form of government in order to do that. Because then they would no longer recognize God-given rights. It would then be a dictatorship. It would be communism. Even in communist, the former Soviet Union, they even had a constitution then. There was just no Second Amendment to keep it in check, to keep the government in check. So it was an unenforceable, really illegitimate document. Well, it says this guy, Mike Barkley, in Northern California, carried a 45 Smith & Wesson as protection against wild boars and mountain lions on his family's Northern California ranch. It also says he knows what crime is like, having owned and managed an apartment complex where he lived for nearly two decades in East Oakland. It says now the Manteca resident is seeking the Democratic nomination for Congress, with his primary campaign platform being to repeal the Second Amendment and any pre-existing doctrine of natural law, common law, or laws under state constitutions that allow the right to keep and bear arms. This is his platform. Barkley, through his qualms, with the individual's exercise, the privilege to possess weapons to protect themselves. To address that, he's proposing a constitutional amendment that would impose an annual tax on every firearm in a household. The tax would start at $10 for the first firearm, $20 for the second, $30 for the third, $100 each for the fourth through ninth firearms, and $1,000 each for any firearms in excess of nine. This is annual taxing. And under his proposed amendment, should a firearm be lost or stolen, it would result in a $1,000 penalty, with the penalty rescinded or refunded if the firearm is recovered. There's a big caveat to that. If the firearm is used in the commission of a felony, then an additional $1,000 penalty would be imposed. He was prompted to run for Congress after the January 8th shooting in Tucson involving Representative Gabby Giffords. Gun control laws aren't working, Barkley said, adding he doesn't expect to move the change. He doesn't expect the move to change the Constitution to be an overnight venture. He noted the women's suffrage movement took 72 years to amend the Constitution, and that it took 85 years after slavery to fully implement civil rights laws. Barkley believes an annual tax would reduce the proliferation of weapons and reduce the ease that many people acquire them for various venues, including gun shows. Now, do you really think this would work? I mean, really. Is anybody actually going to legitimately follow this? Everybody just end up being lawbreakers. Nobody's going to do this. He pointed to Canada as a free country that has stricter gun laws and less violence, where people can still possess guns for self-defense and sport, as an example that repealing the Second Amendment won't take away the ability to own guns. Really. But he does... Barkley credits President George Bush's Tax Reform Act of 1986 for making it possible to sell his East Oakland apartment complex at a profit and reinvest in a complex in Montaca, where he still lives and owns to this day. That makes no sense whatsoever, because George Bush wasn't president in 1986. Ronald Reagan was. Blah, blah, blah. Listen to some of this goofball's platforms. Recognizing the right of women to terminate pregnancies at will and receive funding for it as if for any other medical procedure. So, government-assisted at any moment abortion. Substantial compensation for women who allow their babies to be put up for adoption rather than terminated by abortion. Remove barriers to stem cell research. Ban term limits other than those set by the U.S. Constitution. Well, why stop there? You want to repeal the Second Amendment. Increase fundings for AIDS research. Guys, let me give you my two cents on AIDS. AIDS is a social disease. If you practice irresponsible social behavior, you're at risk for AIDS. I am in a zero at-risk category. Why am I in a zero at-risk category? Well, because the only real ways to get this is now through some sort of bodily transfer that is unprotected and not administered by the medical profession, and intravenous drug use. I do neither. Let's see. Recognize all jurisdictions the validity of same-sex marriage. Advocate the approval of an equal rights amendment. Strengthen NPR. Let's see. Begin a sweep of the Pacific for floating plastic garbage, as well as Somali pirates. Impose a 1 cent tax on cigarettes. Can you believe this? Scumbag. We'll talk about more stuff and forget about this guy after the break. We'll be right back.
Irresponsible people have no business owning a gun or listening to this show. The 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes is back.
Welcome back. Now, the ATF has been getting absolutely hammered during congressional hearings over this Project Gunwalker and Operation Fast and Furious. Here's a story that just came out a couple days ago. The congressional hearings held this week by the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform revealed that the gun smuggling investigation known as Fast and Furious was implemented out of the Phoenix Bureau of the ATF and was conducted in a reckless manner that led to the illegal sale of thousands of firearms. Many of those firearms ended up in the hands of Mexican drug cartels and other criminals, and may have contributed to the death of Border Patrol agent Brian Terry. As well as, it doesn't say in this article, ICE agent Jaime Zapata. Let's see, some of the most important findings in the hearings in the investigative report compiled by the committee staff include ATF knowingly allowed as many as 2,500 firearms to be sold illegally to known or suspected straw purchasers. One of those purchasers accounted for over 700 illegal guns himself. Also, ATF ordered its agents working the program not to arrest illegal gun buyers or to interdict thousands of guns that were allowed to walk, as they call it, into criminal hands. As well, senior ATF officials in Washington were regularly briefed on the operation and approved of the tactics employed. Also, ATF agents who opposed the operations and who raised objections were told to, quote, get with the program and were threatened with job retaliation if they continued their opposition. As well, a number of ATF agents who were assigned to Fast and Furious, well, they testified about the operation. Special Agent John Dodson, in his preliminary testimony, stated, quote, simply put, during this operation known as Fast and Furious, we, ATF, failed to fulfill one of our most fundamental obligations to caretake the public trust, in part to keep guns out of the hands of criminals. Dodson, along with Special Agent Olindo James Casa and Peter Forcelli, each voiced strong opposition to the tactics employed that allowed so many firearms to be sold illegally. In each case, their objections were repeatedly dismissed by ATF superiors. In fact, Special Agent Casa testified that ATF officials sent out an email debunking those opposed to the plan with thinly veiled threats of professional retaliation. Quote, based on my 18 years of experience with ATF, testifying by Casa, he says, I did not think the email was an empty threat and took it very seriously. It has become common practice for the ATF superiors to retaliate against employees that do not blindly toe the company line, no matter what the consequence. Agent Casa stated that agents were ordered not to take action against illegal gun buyers or to seize the firearms. Instead, surveillance was regularly terminated without further action. This is called running protection for those looking for a common phrase. Running a protection racket for illegal activity. Agent Casa went on to describe the operation as recklessly planned and implemented with the purpose of allowing firearms to be illegally trafficked. Now, illegally trafficked, guys, over international borders, which is an international crime. I would right now, right here on 2A Radio, like to elicit and call for Interpol to investigate and, if necessary, arrest those at the ATF and Justice Department involved in this international crime spree, which was coveted, allowed, flourished, and mandated by the U.S. government. Let's see, other testimony contradicted the long-held position of anti-gun politicians that U.S. gun stores are part of a criminal gun traffic, their trafficking efforts. Let's see, in truth, gun dealers regularly cooperate with law enforcement and are a crucial ally in fighting gun trafficking. As Agent Fertelli put it, quote, the gun dealers were our friends. They helped us make a lot of these cases. But the problem is then, by getting them mixed up in this thing and encouraging them to sell guns when they decided to stop, did not help our reputation with the gun industry. You didn't have much of one to begin with. No kidding that it didn't help it. In total, the witness statements and the findings of the staff report paint a shocking picture of an operation that intentionally allowed thousands of guns to end up in the hands of the most violent criminals in North America. It also showed that senior officials at ATF, and not just regional or field supervisors, they approved the operation and received regular reports on its progress. The failure of the ATF to conduct its law enforcement duties in a responsible manner, and the failure of senior leadership to heed the warnings and objections of field agents directly increased the level of violence in the southwest border region and increased the threat by ruthless drug cartels to law enforcement officers and private citizens, both in the U.S. and in Mexico. Now, if the administrative branch of the executive branch of the federal government is knowingly approving, updating, and insisting on illegal behavior by their agents, or fear of some sort of negative retaliation against them, that is illegal. There have been so many federal laws broken in this deal. So many unconstitutional acts. When you have an unconstitutional act that leads to violation of federal law, which in turn leads to violation of international law, there is one word to describe that. It's called treason. Treason, if you'll remember, boys and girls, is the only crime actually listed in the United States Constitution. Treason. Treason against the United States of America is punishable by what? I leave it to you to answer. Anyone? Yes, you in the back row in the blue t-shirt. Correct. Punishable by death. Capital punishment authorized for those convicted of treason against the United States of America. If you're a trusted member of the government, and you not only allow, you insist upon illegal activities of those below you, which result in further violation of not just the Constitution, but newly written federal law, which further relates and commits international crime. That is treason. That's treason against the people. That's treason against the government. That is punishable by death. I call for this investigation to be treated as treasonous acts against the people of the United States. I call for this investigation to be prosecuted under the Articles of Treason. And I call for anyone convicted of these treasonous acts involving all of this with DOJ and ATF to be put to death. Stay tuned. More to come.
You're listening to a guy who packs a gun to shoot the bad guys and packs a mic to shoot his mouth off. Bill Carnes and Two-Way Radio are back.
Welcome back from the break, everyone. Now, these hearings in D.C. over the week, this last Wednesday, show two additional serious problems. First, since the story of this really completely reckless operation became known, the Department of Justice has refused to fully respond to congressional inquiries. Both Representative Daryl Issa, who's a Republican out of California and chairman of the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, and Senator Chuck Grassley, Republican from Iowa, the ranking member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, have repeatedly requested full disclosure, and they've been rebuffed. After nearly 6 months, Department of Justice continues to stonewall. Chairman Issa pointed out that even the information that was provided to the committee was heavily redacted, with most of the key information blacked out. Now, keep in mind, the House of Representatives has the power and authority to subpoena in full documentation from the executive branch. That's part of this balance of power. If the executive branch blacks out this information, that's withholding of evidence, withholding of information, rather, which is illegal. And they might try to cite something such as national security. It's not national security. They couldn't possibly hide behind national security. That's the only thing they can hide behind. Maybe international treachery, but not national security. Well, this exchange between Representative Issa and Assistant Attorney General Ronald Wyke clearly shows the ongoing refusal of the DOJ to cooperate. Here's Issa. He says, who authorized this program that got people killed? Who here in Washington authorized it? Wyke says, we don't know. We don't know is also the answer Attorney General Eric Holder provided to that same question when asked just a few weeks ago. But after 6 months of scandal and scrutiny, it seems hard to believe that the Attorney General still can't answer this simple question. Or is it that he just simply won't answer the question? The hearings also revealed just how far the anti-gun apologists for the Obama regime will go to change the subject and try to use any crisis to advance their anti-gun agenda. Here's Representative Elijah Cummings, Democrat out of Maryland, the ranking member of the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, attempted to turn the hearings into a discussion of our gun laws. He announced that the Democrats on the committee would hold their own hearings to bring in witnesses that will argue for more gun control laws. Even in the face of overwhelming evidence of the reckless misuse of the authority of law enforcement by ATF and the agent's internal failure to stop the illegal sale of firearms to criminals, Representative Cummings and other anti-gun politicians still believe that more gun laws, anti-gun laws, are needed. In fact, the investigation of this scandal proves that federal and state law enforcement, including ATF, have all the tools they need except the leadership needed to conduct criminal investigations in a responsible manner. Clearly, in the case of Operation Fast and Furious, that leadership failed spectacularly. Well, Iowa Senator Charles Grassley, he is widely known for his devotion to detail and holding government accountable. In his opening remarks at this last week's blockbuster hearing of the ATF, their Operation Fast and Furious, reinforced this reputation of his and perhaps laid the groundwork for an overhaul of the ATF. ATF insiders say that a complete shakeup and shakeout of the agency is necessary and that the Fast and Furious investigation may just be that catalyst. Grassley was the lead witness before Congressman Daryl Issa's House Committee this last week. He pulled no punches in revealing how the ATF's gun-running sting, how that operation went south, both figuratively and literally. It was a bad day for the ATF, but an even worse one for the ATF administrators and supervisors who oversaw what became this total debacle, allowing hundreds, actually thousands of guns, to fall into criminal hands. It wasn't too good a day for the Justice Department either. Let's see. ATF is supposed... This is what Issa told the committee. He said ATF is supposed to stop criminals from trafficking guns to Mexico, to Mexican drug cartels. Instead, ATF made it easier for alleged cartel middlemen to get weapons from U.S. gun dealers. Agents were ordered to stand by and watch these middlemen, these straw purchasers, buy hundreds upon hundreds of weapons. Agents warned that inaction could lead to tragedy, but management didn't want to listen. Grassley didn't stop there. He spread a wide net of blame that points to the highest reaches of the Obama regime. Who thought this was a good idea? Why did this happen? The president said he didn't authorize it, and that the attorney general didn't authorize it. They have both admitted that a serious mistake may have been made. There are lots of questions and lots of investigating to do, but one thing has become clear already. It was no mistake. It was a conscious decision by senior officials. It was written down. It was briefed up to Washington, D.C. According to an internal briefing paper, Operation Fast and Furious was intentionally designed to, quote, allow the transfer of firearms to continue to take place. We're authorizing not only the breaking of the law, but the protection of the breaking of the law. Treason. Grassley's investigators and those dispatched by Congressman Issa have turned up a goldmine of information on what is now evidently a horribly botched operation that violated ATF traditional interdiction policies and practices, not to mention countless federal and international laws. I would imagine state laws in the state of Arizona as well. Why doesn't the Attorney General for the state of Arizona intervene and start arresting people from the ATF for violating state law? You might say federal supremacy. Well, murder, or rather should I say, when it comes to Border Patrol agents, that the agent that died, Brian Terry, murder is not exempt from federal supremacy laws. It doesn't work that way. Accessory to murder is really what he should probably have these people on. Let's see. ATF agents appeared at the hearing this week and offered stunning testimony about supervisors in the agency's Phoenix field office who ordered them to stand down and allow known or suspected gun traffickers to walk away with hundreds of firearms. Many of these guns, but hardly all of them, have subsequently turned up at crime scenes on both sides of the border. Of course, the most notorious one is found at the scene of the murder of Border Patrol agent Brian Terry. Senator Grassley figuratively asked questions for which he and others have been seeking answers for precisely 6 months. Terry was murdered last December 15th, and the House hearing was held on June 15th, exactly 6 months. Grassley offered this. ATF encouraged gun dealers to sell to straw buyers. Emails prove that at least one dealer worried prophetically about the risk. He wrote to ATF about his concerns that a Border Patrol agent might end up facing the wrong end of one of these guns. The supervisors allowed it, and that's the way it went. Stay tuned. More after the break.
If you live in a state which allows Class 3 NFA firearms and accessories, and you either have an interest in or already own Class 3 NFA items, the process for an individual to own these items includes photographs, fingerprints, obtaining a letter of permission from your police chief or sheriff, and a full personal background check which is spread across the whole federal system. Until now. Forming an NFA trust eliminates the requirements of letters of permission and all personal data and background checks in purchasing and possessing NFA firearms and accessories. NFA trusts offer a level of anonymity as well as flexibility in the purchasing, possessing, and storage of your Class 3 NFA firearms and accessories. To learn more about forming a secure and flexible NFA trust at a fraction of the cost from attorneys, visit www.billcarnes.com and click on the NFA tab. That's BILLCARNS.com and click on the NFA tab.
You can have the alcohol and tobacco. Leave the firearms to us. The 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes is back.
Welcome back from the break, everyone. Now, here's the question. Why would the ATF enter into anything such as Gunwalker or Fast and Furious? Why indeed? Ostensibly, the operation was hatched in an effort to bring down a major drug cartel. But is that the job of the ATF? Perhaps Chairman Issa put it best in his opening statement when he recalled, "When Senator Chuck Grassley, who we welcome here today, and I first learned about Operation Fast and Furious earlier this year, we were both shocked that such a blatantly reckless program was ever conceived, authorized, or executed by a federal law enforcement agency." Well, as it turned out, according to Grassley's remarks, ATF was not alone in this venture, although none of the other agencies whose fingerprints are on this operation have been in any rush to come forward. Grassley revealed, on October 26, 2009, emails indicated that there was a meeting of senior law enforcement officials at the Justice Department. It appears to have included the heads of every law enforcement component of the department, including directors of the FBI, the DEA, and the ATF. It also included the U.S. attorneys for all the Southwest border states, the director of the Organized Crime Drug Enforcement Task Force, and the chair of the Attorney General's Advisory Committee. And the senator wasn't finished. He detailed just one specific part of the investigation involving two men whose names would become the broken cornerstones of the Fast and Furious operation. 4 days later, the Phoenix Field Division began investigating Uriel Patino on suspicion of being involved in a gun trafficking ring. 10 days after that, Patino was assigned one of those case numbers. In the first 24 days that the ATF was on him, Patino bought 34 guns from dealers cooperating with the ATF. That's nearly three times more than the typical gun trafficking operation, according to a study that the Wall Street Journal had done. That was just the beginning. Since the dealers were cooperating, ATF received notices of each purchase right away. Analysts entered the serial numbers into ATF's suspected gun database, usually within the same day of the purchase. On November 20th, one of the 34 guns that Patino bought turned up in Mexico, just 14 days after he bought it in Mexico. That means it turned up, as in the Mexican officials got a hold of it and got it to ATF for tracing. ATF learned of the recovery through a hit in the suspect's gun database on November 24th. That same day, Patino bought Jaime Avila, brought Jaime Avila, pardon me, into a cooperating gun dealer, and they bought five more guns. ATF had real-time notice of the dealer, and agents rushed to the store to follow them, but they arrived a little too late. Over the next 6 weeks, Avila bought 13 guns at dealers cooperating with the ATF. The dealers notified ATF of each purchase right away. Analysts entered the serial numbers into the ATF database, usually within about 2 days of the purchase. Yet ATF did nothing to deter or interrupt the straw purchasers. Avila went back to the cooperating dealer and purchased three more AK-47 type weapons, whatever that means, I don't know, on January 16th of 2010, a year and a half ago. ATF simply put the serial number into its database. Still, ATF did nothing to stop Avila or Patino. 11 months later, two of those three rifles were recovered at the scene of Agent Terry's murder. During those 11 months, Avila purchased another 34 firearms, and Patino purchased 539. Grassley made it clear that in the closing sentences of his statement, that this investigation is not about gun control or furthering the agenda of gun prohibitionists. Anti-gun senators Dianne Feinstein, Chuck Schumer, who's one of his proteges, was Congressman Anthony Weiner. Sheldon Whitehouse, they all issued a special report earlier in the week calling for more gun regulations as their answer to gun running to Mexico. This tells you just how stupid these people are. How stupid. I don't mean ignorant. Ignorance can be fixed through provided information. Stupid can't be fixed. This is felony stupid. This is treasonous stupid. Dianne Feinstein is treasonous stupid. Chuck Schumer is treasonous stupid. Sheldon Whitehouse is treasonous stupid. They're calling for more regulations as their answer to gun running to Mexico. Let me tell those of you who are not felony stupid, and the felony stupids can tune in, maybe they'll get it figured out, I don't know. The laws against gun running to Mexico are already on the books, have already been on the books, both nationally, at the state level in Arizona, and in the international level, including in Mexico where the guns were going. The laws are already on the books. What happened was Department of Justice authorized ATF, with possible knowledge, as it would seem, by FBI, DEA, that they were going to violate the laws themselves and allow the criminals to do illegal things and protect their illegal activity. You don't need more laws on the books. The laws are there. Due to treason by Department of Justice is how these things happen. Now, Grassley observed the following. He says, too often, we want to make everything about politics. We pick sides and only listen to what we want to hear. Well, one might remind Representative Cummings, Elijah Cummings, William Lacey Clay and Carolyn Maloney, all Democrat members of the House committee, about this at the time that the investigation continues to unfold. But Grassley's final words on the matter put his issue in the clearest perspective. It's time to get to the truth and hold our government accountable. Well, you're absolutely right. Now, on the heels of all of this, a report comes out of Mexico City that says about 70% of the guns seized in Mexico and submitted to a U.S. gun tracing program came from the United States, according to a report released Monday by U.S. senators, three of them. And what does the report say? The report says 70% of arms seized in Mexico come from U.S. When in fact, it's 70% of the arms that are seized and turned over to the ATF for tracing come from the U.S. They say of the 29,284 firearms recovered by authorities in Mexico in 2009 and 2010, 20,504 came from the U.S., according to figures provided by the senators, which were provided to them by the very ATF who's supplying the guns south of the border. Most of the weapons, 15,000, were made in the U.S., while another roughly 5,400 were of foreign manufacturers, but haven't moved, but had moved through the U.S. into Mexico. The U.S. said the remainder of the total weapons, 8,800, were of undetermined origin due to insufficient information provided. Now, this is information coming out of Mexico through the ATF to who? The tyrannically felony stupid Dianne Feinstein, Chuck Schumer, and Sheldon Whitehouse, who's out of Rhode Island, by the way. Feinstein out of California, Schumer out of New York, Whitehouse out of Rhode Island. Treasonous, felony, stupid. Now, on Saturday, in a speech to the Mexican-American community in San Jose, California, Mexico's President Felipe Calderon lashed out at the U.S. weapons industry. He says, I accuse the U.S. weapons industry of irresponsibility for the deaths of thousands of people that are occurring in Mexico, for its profit, for the profits that it makes for the weapons industry. Really. Calderon endorsed calls for reinstating the ban on domestic sales of assault rifles, saying its expiration in 2004 may have played a role in the increase of drug violence in Mexico. He says, you can clearly see how the violence began to grow in 2005, and of course it has gone upward spiral in the last 6 years. Let me tell you something, Felipe. The violence in Mexico from the drug cartels has to do with you poking a sharp stick right into the chest and heart of the drug cartels while everyone around you is completely corrupt. The corruption in Mexico and poking a sharp stick directly into the chest of all of the drug cartels is what's responsible for the violence. If you want to take these drug cartels down, let me explain how to do it in English, because I don't speak Spanish very well. One at a time. You do not fight a multi-front war. You will never win a multi-front war. Sun Tzu, The Art of War. What really killed Hitler in his attempt to take over the world? Invading Poland and Russia. Hence, committing his military to a two-front war. That was the beginning of the end for that guy. You are taking on countless cartels. One at a time, buddy. One at a time. Stay tuned. We'll be back for hour two of 2A Radio right after the break. We'll be right back.
Gun control, loved by dictators since 1917. The 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes is back.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm going to get to a listener email. We've spoken before about cold lapping of a rifle barrel. Now, lapping of any rifle barrel will help it out. Really, a new rifle barrel is really where it begins. And we're talking about a barrel where you want to get some accuracy out of it. A battle rifle, a sport utility rifle, something like that, really not that big a deal. Do it if you want to get a little bit better accuracy out of it. But you got a hunting rifle, a precision rifle, something along that lines, something you want to get some accurate distance out of. Cold lapping is a great way to go. So I'm going to go through the cold lapping procedure rather than typing all of this out in an email response to the listener. I'm going to get this out for everyone. Cold lapping of a rifle barrel. Really what you want to do is you want to get a few products. You want to get a simple one-process barrel cleaner. I recommend something like M-Pro 7 bore cleaning gel. M-Pro 7 bore cleaning gel will do a very good job at cleaning all kinds of stuff out of the barrel. It is not the best stuff for any one material substance. Usually in these barrels, what you're finding is copper and carbon contamination in the bore. And M-Pro 7 bore gel will do a good job at both. If you have a new barrel, you're not really cleaning much of either of those out. You're just really kind of seasoning and prepping the barrel. So clean it with something like the M-Pro 7 bore gel. The gel is better than the liquids because if you use a liquid, it'll start to pool at the bottom of the barrel. So if you use a gel, the gel is not quite as affected by gravity. It will actually stay in the lands and grooves and towards the top of the barrel. It will fight gravity just a bit. So use something good like that. Clean out the bore. Then get yourself a good product. You get this from Brownells. It's called JB Bore Bright. They also have JB Bore Paste. I recommend JB Bore Bright, which is kind of a reddish pink color. And what it is it is a internal bore polish. Now, when the rifling is cut into the barrel, what you end up with is like if you have a skill saw and you cut a piece of wood. You get little fragments of wood that, you know, go up and go down a little bit. They come out of the line in which you're cutting. When barreling is cut, or if it's even hammer forged in and then the rifling dowel is taken out, you end up with some of these same sort of little splinters, like when you cut the piece of plywood with your skill saw, in microscopic form. You want to get rid of those. Well, the best way to get rid of those is really to kind of ease them back and forth. You do that through this cold lapping process and then polish any of the rough edges out. That's why this process works so well. So you get yourself one of these cotton or wool bore cleaning mops, which is caliber specific. Let's say it's a 30 caliber rifle. You're doing a 30-30, a 308, 30-06, 300 Win Mag, 300 Whisper, all the different 30s. You get a 30 caliber bore mop. You grab your JB Bore Paste. I'm sorry, JB Bore Bright. My mistake. JB Bore Bright, the reddish pink stuff. The Bore Paste is blue. You get the reddish pinkish stuff, the JB Bore Bright. And after the bore has been cleaned out and it's dry, you take this stuff and you really work it into the mop, the caliber specific, caliber appropriate mop. And you run that back and forth all the way down the bore. Just start from the chamber end all the way down the bore to where the mop is now poking out of the muzzle, and then all the way back. That is one full pass. You go all the way down and all the way back. One pass. All the way down, all the way back. Pass number two. It's actually gone through the rifle four times, but it's going over those little microscopic burrs in one direction, then back the other direction. That is one pass. You do that about 50 times. 5-0. Then you clean out the barrel again. Grab your M-Pro 7 bore gel or something like that, and you clean out the bore. When you clean the bore, you wet it. Then you get yourself a nylon brush, because this bore paste can embed into the rifling. Get a nylon brush. Don't use a stainless steel brush. Don't use a brass brush. Don't use a bronze brush. Don't use a copper brush. Use a nylon caliber-specific brush. In this case, it would be 30 caliber. You clean it out, and then you run patches until the bore is clean. Then you repeat the process. New mop, new bunch of JB Bore Bright, embed it in there with your fingers, right? Run it through 50 full passes. Then clean it again, as we just described. Do this. Now, you'll notice that the mop with the JB Bore Bright on it turns black. What happens when metal is actually polished clean? Whatever you're polishing it with, it turns black. Tiny little microscopic pieces of metal, when they're not stuck together, turn black. Look at your metal door hinges on the doors in your house. There's a little bit of black around there. That's the metal scraping away. Go out and polish the chrome bumper on your vehicle. What do you get? That polish, it starts to turn black. That's what's happening. You're removing any of the bumps and protrusions in the bore with this process. Now, do this as many as four times, so you have 200 full passes, breaking it 50 to clean out the bore and clean it beautifully. When you're done, now, you can sometimes get away with it if it's a good quality barrel, doing it just twice. Sometimes three times. Sometimes you have to go four. If you get a Barrett 50 caliber rifle, they admittedly say that their rifles are rough when they come out of the factory with the rifling. You might have to do yours 6 to 8 times. It's a lot of work. It's an afternoon if you have to do it that many times. Otherwise, 45 minutes or an hour. Cold lap it. Do not fire lap your bores. You're only pushing these little twigs of metal in one direction, directly into the lands of the rifle. You want to bend them back and forth without so much force. Get rid of them, then polish the area where they were when they broke off. Cold lapping is the way to go. Once you're done with however many processes you do, 2, 4, 6, whatever you end up doing on your rifle, clean it. Clean it beautifully. Do not reuse patches. I've gone through the cleaning process. I have, as a matter of fact, I have done a precision rifle cleaning guide on DVD, which has been fully edited. We're getting some of the artwork done. We'll have it up online, available in hopefully another, 6 to 8 weeks or so. We should have everything done. Get them ordered up. You want to have this cold lapping done before you go shoot the gun. And you don't have to do the fire one, clean it, fire one, clean it, fire one, clean it, fire five, clean it, fire. You don't have to do any of that. Do the cold lapping process. Your bore's ready to go. Just ensure that you clean it properly with a good quality cleaner. Do not use CLP. That stuff sucks in a rifle bore. Don't use it. not in anything where you want accuracy. The oil will not compress when it's left in there. The lubricant and the preservative are left in your bore. It will change pressures and negatively affect your accuracy. So there you go on the cold lapping. Stay tuned. More to come after the break. We'll be right back.
Tell everyone in the room to pipe down. Two-Way Radio with Bill Carnes is back.
Welcome back from the break, everyone. Now, this next article that I'm going to go over with you shows the absolute mental handicapped, how mentally handicapped and purely stupid and just, I guess, intellectually unrefined, un-American, and socially inept some of these vehemently anti-gunners truly are. The Violence Policy Center, VPC, which is as anti-gun as you can get, they live, exist, and operate every moment of their lives anti-gun. That's what they're all about. They're saying to forget all about the ATS Project Gunwalker and Fast and Furious, and instead demilitarize gun sales. Forget about all the laws and that were broken by Department of Justice and ATF. Forget all about treasonous acts by your government. Forget about it. Forget about the deaths that have occurred due to the DOJ and ATF's inactions. And instead, demilitarize gun sales. Listen to this. Widespread sale of military-style weapons drives illicit traffic to Mexico, increases armed attacks on U.S. law enforcement officers, and facilitates mass shootings. Or, so the Violence Policy Center would have you believe. Now, here's the real story of it. These sorts of weapons, they increase attacks in Mexico. I'm sorry, they increase trafficking to Mexico because the ATF runs protection. It also says that it would increase armed attacks on U.S. law enforcement officers. Absolutely untrue. Most cops are shot with their own guns. And it also says that it facilitates mass shootings. When it comes to military-style guns, single percent mass shootings occur with a military-style gun. All lies by VPC. Let's see. This is all in their report, The Militarization of the U.S. Firearms Market. That's what it's entitled. The basic premise, the U.S. gun industry is desperate for new customers. To counteract declining sales, the firearms manufacturers are appealing to the soldier within. It's the usual issue of lies, recycled and barely repackaged, blending facts with conjecture without anything remotely resembling a proper definition of terms of things like, what, assault rifle, right? Keep in mind, gun sales have been on the rise since the 2008 presidential primaries, really, when Obama was nominated by the Democrats to run for president. Since then, gun sales have been astronomical. They're not declining. Let's see, because federal law has banned the sale of new machine guns to civilians since 1986, and heavily regulate sales to civilians of pre-1986 machine guns, there's virtually no civilian market for military assault weapons. The gun industry introduced semiotic versions of these deadly military assault weapons in order to create and exploit civilian markets, according to VPC. The world's armies developed assault weapons to meet specific combat needs. All assault weapons, military and civilian alike, incorporate specific features that were designed for laying down a high volume of fire over a wide killing zone. This is sometimes known as hosing down an area, according to VPC. Civilian assault weapon features the specific military design features that make spray firing easy and distinguish assault weapons from traditional sporting firearms. Now, you see what they've done here? In the same breath, they distinguish military weaponry from civilian. The VPC just convolutes the two. From there, we get 22 ARs as a kind of a getaway drug to bigger, badder, deadlier military-style weapons. And there's a problem, because criminals, specifically drug traffickers, were drawn to assault-style weapons' massive firepower, useful for fighting police and especially competing traffickers. Survivalists, who envision themselves fending off a horde of desperate neighbors from within their bomb shelters, loved the combat features of high ammunition capacity and anti-personnel striking power of assault weapons. Right-wing paramilitary extremists and their ongoing battle against the Zionist occupational government made these easily purchased firearms their gun of choice. And for gun enthusiast fans of popular entertainment, Rambo and Miami Vice semi-automatic assault weapons offered the look and feel of the real thing. This is all VPC talking here. Self-defense, hunting, fun, nope. Semi-automatic rifles are for drug thugs, survivalist nutcases, right-wing nutcases, and Walter Mitty-style nutcases. Now, where did I put that misleading stat about American gun stores supplying Mexican drug cartels? Yeah. Thanks, VPC, for basically everybody being a nutcase. Now, you're people who've never fired guns. You have no experience with guns. But you'll sit and you'll ridicule others. It's like, oh, man. I hate girls who drive around in convertible pink Volkswagen Bugs. They're so pretentious. Now, how would that sit? We're basically those blonde, pink, convertible Volkswagen Beetle driving girls in their eyes. We're just lumped together. They know nothing about the car, nothing about the people who drive the car, nothing about the gun, nothing about the people who own or shoot the gun. It's just all conjecture. Now, they say that trafficking in military-style weapons from the U.S., according to both U.S. and Mexican officials, large numbers of military-style firearms from the U.S. civilian gun market fuel criminal violence in Mexico. Congressional hearings and public policy reports have made it clear that U.S. gun industry is instrumental in making readily available to illegal gun traffickers these types of numbers. The manufacturers have a lot of middlemen. It goes from a manufacturer to a distributor to a wholesaler to the retailer to the end user. Manufacturers aren't doing any of this. And the ATF has been allowing it in Phoenix and Arizona. Now, they also say U.S. and Mexican officials report that, based on firearms tracing data from the FBI and ATF, the cartels obtain up to 90% of their firearms from the United States. Oy vey. The stat, the lie that would not die. Again, the Mexican drug cartels are getting the vast majority of their guns from military and law enforcement sales through corruption in Mexico. Why the hell doesn't the VPC call the Freedom Group onto the carpet about that? Because the VPC... They love Big Brother in general and the ATF specifically. The gun industry has circled its wagons ahead of the congressional hearings of ATF's Gunwalker scandal. They're completely out of touch with the reality of the situation in Mexico, where unarmed civilians are oppressed by government-supported, both U.S. and Mexico, criminals. Through the U.S. government, Department of Justice and ATF helping filter these guns south, and then in Mexico, through the corruption within the government. How out of touch can the VPC possibly be? My goodness. The most incestuously, the gun lobby's exploitations of fear radical ethnic and political, encourages just... they're nuts. They're absolutely nuts. I can't even get into it. Stay tuned, guys. More to come after the break. We'll be right back.
Your right to listen and take action shall not be infringed. The 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes is back.
Welcome back. Well, about 10 days ago, after a six-day trial, a judge found Baltimore police officer Gaji Tshamba guilty of manslaughter in the shooting death last year of a U.S. Marine veteran, Tyrone Brown. The attorneys wrapped up their argument shortly before noon, and Baltimore Circuit Court Judge Edward R.K. Harrigan, Hargadin, recessed for 2 hours to make his decision. Quote, the defendant overreacted and, in fact, exasperated the whole tragic set of events, said Baltimore Circuit Judge Hargadin. Let's see, a picture of Tshamba, the cop, leaving the courthouse on Wednesday, really kind of showed his face of astonishment, like, oh my God, what did I do? Just really more so, I guess I got caught. How did I get caught? More than 21 witnesses appeared over 6 days, offering varied accounts of what happened, or what was likely to have happened, the morning of June 5th, 2010, when Tshamba, who was off duty, shot Tyrone Brown 12 times in a Mount Vernon alley as bars were letting out. What happened in that alley dealt with male ego, alcohol, women, and a gun, says Assistant State's Attorney Kevin Wiggins in his final arguments. He said, anywhere you put that, it's a bad combination. Brown, 32, had been drinking, and he groped one of Tshamba's female companions that morning, sometime after 1 a.m. That was one of the few uncontested facts of the case. But what happened afterward was harder to gauge, as testimony of one witness frequently contradicted the testimony of another. Prosecutors said Tshamba was power mad and angry, using his weapon to intimidate and eventually kill Brown, a much larger man. While the defense claimed Brown charged the officer, who had to react with lethal force to save his life and that of others. That was his defense. Defense attorneys entered a 9-page selection from the victim's military records into evidence that showed Brown had a history of violence. The judge's decision came down to credibility and which witness he believed. He says, quote, the court rejects the defendant's version of the events. And he explains that. The case involved, again, Tyrone Brown. There's no dispute the defendant and three female friends were at the rear door of the Red Maple at Edgar and Morton Streets around 1 a.m. Mr. Brown, his sister, and Miss Kingley and Miss Dodge were walking south on Morton Street. Miss Ramsey said one of the defendant's friends was on the ramp outside of the Red Maple when Mr. Brown touched her inappropriate on the buttocks. This is the cop's friend. The Marine touched the cop's friend's backside. From this point forward, the version of the various witnesses differed. The court had to grapple with what are seemingly very just divergent accounts of what happened. All right? From this standpoint, it's important to determine which witnesses were credible. Credibility is determined not just by whether someone else is literally lying, but also whether the witness had a bias or motive not to be completely straightforward, whether intentionally or subconsciously, whether the witness was able to see or hear things about which they testified. Well, does the witness have an interest in the outcome of the case? Did the witness appear to be telling the truth? And what was the witness's behavior on the stand? And what was their manner of testifying? All of these things are weighed. So with all of that considered. That's where Judge Edward R.K. Hargenden issued his ruling. Why there wasn't a jury in this case, I have no idea. I really don't. I don't understand the process. It's Maryland. I've never even... Yeah, I guess I have been to Maryland. But, I mean... What we have is we have a little man with the little man's complex. And he's backed up with the full force and effect of a badge and a gun, which makes even the biggest man have the little man complex where they need to be even bigger men. So this guy was really a problem. This cop was really a problem. When I was a cop, I didn't even carry my badge and gun with me all the time. When I was off duty, I didn't feel the need to always have my badge on me. I didn't feel the need to always have my gun with me. Why? I was a cop 40 hours a week. You ask just about anybody who's got a badge and a gun. They're a police officer, a law enforcement officer, whatever. Ask them what they do. What is their answer? I'm a cop. Really. They make their entire identity around being a cop. Same thing goes for others. I'm a doctor. Their entire identity comes from being a doctor. When I was a cop, people ask me what I do. I'd tell them, I work for the police department. Really, what do you do? Well, I'm a cop. You're a cop? Well, 40 hours a week, yes. I work four 10-hour shifts. 40 hours a week, I'm a cop. The rest of the time, I'm not. There's 168 hours in a week. 168 hours in a week. 128 hours, I was not a cop. 40 hours, I was. Over three times the amount of time I was not a cop. Only just less than a quarter of the time. 23-24% of the time, I was a police officer. The other 76-77% of the time, I was not. I didn't feel the necessity to identify my entire existence as a cop. Too many cops do that. How many cops have you ever met? They're probably not good friends of yours, unless you are also a cop. That they are cops. All of their friends are cops. People they hang out with, the guys that they talk to on the phone, message back and forth with, share emails back and forth with, all have to do with cop-related stuff. They're all cops. Oftentimes, they're married to women who are cops. Or there are women who are married to men who are cops. Or maybe they're gay or lesbian in a gay or lesbian relationship to other cops. All too often, it's everything in their life has to do with them and other people who are in the same line of work. How many doctors do you know that only hang out with other doctors, and all they ever do is talk about doctor stuff? The problem with a lot of cops is they don't know when to turn it off. They don't just leave it at the office. They never do. And every ounce of what they do has to be, I'm a cop. And that is, really, that is a psychological, mental disturbance. When what you do for a living in the civilian world, what you do for, and of course, go, I'm not a civilian. Yes, you are. 128 hours a week, yes, you are. In a non-military environment, if you're in the military, oftentimes, it's 24/7 being in the military, depending on your job function, what branch you're in, what you're assigned to. If you're in the Navy on board a ship, 24/7, you're never getting off the ship. You're never going home and seeing your folks. If you're deployed overseas in a combat zone, 24/7. Police don't have that. Cops don't have that. But when they make it about that, or anybody else for that matter, if you sell paint, and you only hang out with other people who sell paint and other wall coatings and textures, and all you ever do is talk about paint stuff, and when you get together with your paint buddies, and all you ever do is you talk about painting and paint and problems with paint and people who paint, would you not look at that person and think, there's some real psychological issues with this person? They're just not wrapped right. the exact same thing happens in the world of policing. A lot of people just don't want to call it what it is, and I will. Stay tuned, guys. More to come after the break. We'll be right back.
If you live in a state which allows Class 3 NFA firearms and accessories, and you either have an interest in or already own Class 3 NFA items, the process for an individual to own these items includes photographs, fingerprints, obtaining a letter of permission from your police chief or sheriff, and a full personal background check, which is spread across the whole federal system. Until now. Forming an NFA trust eliminates the requirements of letters of permission and all personal data and background checks in purchasing and possessing NFA firearms and accessories. NFA trusts offer a level of anonymity as well as flexibility in the purchasing, possessing, and storage of your Class 3 NFA firearms and accessories. To learn more about forming a secure and flexible NFA trust at a fraction of the cost from attorneys, visit www.billcarnes.com and click on the NFA tab. That's BILLCARNS.com and click on the NFA tab.
As long as politicians attack our rights, Bill will be fighting for them. Two-Way Radio with Bill Carnes is back.
Back up, I'll take you on. Headstrong to take on anyone. I know that you are wrong if this is not where you belong.
And welcome back from the break, everyone. Now, there's a story that we went over, just last month in May. About the state Supreme Court judges in the state of Indiana making a ruling that citizens have absolutely no legal authority whatsoever to stop the illegal entry of police into their homes. Whether the cop knows that they're illegally entering the home or not, that the citizens of Indiana are now by law forbidden from resisting that entry. Their course of action? To take it up in civil law later. To sue. So what they've made is home invasion by police a civil matter as opposed to a criminal matter. They've converted that law effectively with their 3-2 ruling. Well, a backlash has begun against the Indiana Supreme Court ruling that homeowners have no right to resist a police officer's illegal entry, but that they're allowed to argue it in a civil court later. State lawmakers are seeking a change in the state statutes and asking the court to make the judges fix the problem themselves. A constitutional expert contends that the moves are needed because the court's arguments essentially are the same as the idea that someone can't use a firearm to protect himself from someone who is threatening to kill him. A later argument over such use of a firearm might well be of no help to the person who wanted to protect himself. The expert, Herb Titus, of William J. Olson, PC Attorney at Law, that was his opinion. He says he might be dead. According to local reports, when the ruling was released last month, the state Supreme Court concluded that, quote, allowing resistance to an illegal police entry unnecessarily escalates the level of violence and therefore the risk of injuries to all parties involved without preventing the arrest. So basically what they're saying is it's already bad enough. Just take your beating and get arrested. And then, you know, argue it later in court. We're not going to prevent this. We're just going to tell you that you can argue it later in court. The panel, in a 3-2 vote, said the people who are victimized by police entering their homes illegally must not resist, but instead could pursue a complaint later through the court system. The case originated with police officers who responded to a report of a domestic dispute outside of a home. When the officers wanted to follow the man into his home, he resisted, and they shot him with a taser and arrested him. Quote, although some state legislatures have abrogated the common law right to resist arrest, Indiana has not. This is explained in a friend of the court brief filed by dozens of state lawmakers. They say the right to resist arrested, the right to resist arrested in the streets is quite different from the right to resist unlawful entry into one's home for arrest, investigation, or any other purpose. The brief asking the state Supreme Court to rehear the case said, quote, the public policy of the state has embodied in the 2006 legislation has been a grant to grant our citizens greater autonomy to protect themselves from unlawful incursions into their homes. Now, according to the brief, the state in 2006 specifically adopted a law that explains a person is justified in using reasonable force, including deadly force, against any other person and does not have a duty to retreat. If the person reasonably believes that the force is unnecessary to prevent or terminate the person's unlawful entry of or attack on the person's dwelling, curtilage, or occupied motor vehicle. Basically, it's the castle doctrine. And the cops, now thanks to the state Supreme Court, are exempt from the castle doctrine. Here's a quote. Any rule that encourages immediate surrender whenever a person hears the word police or sees a badge could expose citizens to a great risk of harm. For example, a serial killer in Pennsylvania used a police disguise to gain entry into a home where he raped and strangled a woman. And men claiming to be narcotics agents in Alabama kicked in a door and sold money after hitting the occupant in the head. These headlines need not be replicated in Indiana. Rather, granting rehearing is appropriate to narrow this court's holding and apprise of our citizens that they retain the vulnerable right to reasonably resist unlawful entry into their homes by police. Now, State Senator Mike Young, who played a key role in getting the 71 lawmakers together on the brief, also confirmed that he would craft legislation to respond to the court's ruling. At the time, Young noted the judges, quote, overturned a basic common law that date back to the English Magna Carta nearly 800 years ago. This flies in the face of our Fourth Amendment right to the U.S. Constitution, protecting us against unreasonable search and seizure. Now, when somebody enters your home illegally at 3 a.m., your first thought is not what court would have jurisdiction, but rather, what do I need to do to protect my family, says Young. Herb Titus says the few issues before this court have galvanized the public's attention and concern as much as the declaration in this case that the right to reasonably resist an unlawful police entry into a home is no longer recognized under Indiana law. Rehearing is appropriate to reconsider that holding in light of Indiana's robust self-defense statute. But Justice Stephen David wrote for the court that if a police officer decides to enter a home for any reason or no reason at all, a homeowner cannot do anything to stop him. In effect, this means a cop can randomly stop, walk up to your front door, enter in, whether by opening the door, ringing the doorbell, pushing you to the sides, or kicking it in. And at the time, you cannot do anything to stop him. This, folks, is called a police state. If you haven't considered that United States is already into a police state, well, Indiana just confirmed it through the Supreme Court. Even State Attorney General Greg Zoeller, who argued the winning side in the state Supreme Court case, endorsed the idea of a rehearing, believing that the state Supreme Court went way too far. He says, in supporting a rehearing, the state will continue to argue that the conviction should be upheld, but on more narrow grounds. We contend that under the circumstances, the police entry of the residence was legal. The officers responding to call to the 911 call sought to avoid leaving the alleged victim with the defendant after a confrontation outside. So while there is no right to commit battery with police, I believe the individual has the right to shut the door, stand his ground, and communicate with police without engaging in an altercation. In balancing the perils of domestic violence with respect to law enforcement, I will continue to advise our police clients to respect people's Fourth Amendment rights. Titus said that the court's move is sympathetic in the moves of the U.S. courts to weaken the principle of private property. Do you realize we're one of the only countries in the world that actually gets to have private property ownership? But yet, it's still not completely ours. You go, you buy property absolutely outright. You own it. But if you don't pay your property taxes on it, it will be taken away from you. A tax on a right to own private property. Taxing our rights. Whole problem with the income tax. We have a right to work. Supreme Court has ruled you can only tax a privilege, and that working is a right. Therefore, those wages are untaxable, except by these very narrow provisions. Essentially, if you get your money from the federal government by way of military or other employment, or you are an alien deriving U.S. source income. That's about it. But the government doesn't care. Let's see. We recently filed a brief in the U.S. Supreme Court in another case involving GPS searches, is what Titus said. And our brief, we will urge the court to return to the original meaning in the Fourth Amendment, which is based on property as contrary to privacy. Thanks for being here this week, guys. We'll be back next week.
I'd like to close by saying, to those of you within our government, we will be watching you in Congress, the executive, and judicial branches all very closely as we organize to save our freedom, liberty, and country. We will not become the subjects of governmental rule.
Thanks for tuning in. Bill will be back tomorrow. Now go side in and shoot straight. The 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes. Learn more about Bill at BillCarnes.com. Send your comments to Bill at 2aradio.com.